We've been looking forward to having Martha with us, and I'm delighted that she could come. She's one of the most genuinely original and thoughtful people on our campus. She teaches in the honors program. She writes for a number of important and impressive publications, such as the Wall Street Journal and the Weekly Standard. She blogs at the World Affairs Journal. Hole in Our Soul, which is her first book, which was where I first got to know her, was an incredible book that just absolutely provided a view of popular music that I had never encountered before, and I still recommend reading it many, many years later. Your new book will be coming out in 2011 from Yale.
Yeah.
America's, I haven't done. America's Cultural Footprint?
Tentative title.
Tentative title. And what you'll be talking about today is Exporting the First Freedom, which I assume is related to the book.
Mm-hmm. It is.
A pleasure to have you, Martha.
Thank you. After an introduction like that, it's always tempting to quit while you're ahead and not even give the talk. Thank you. And thank Eric and Kitsy and everyone who made this event possible, including all of those of you who came in out of the spring sunshine. My book is a work in progress, so I'm eager for questions and feedback. And yes, this topic is sort of pulled a little bit from a couple of different sections of the book. I'll start by saying that in the recent debate over the condition of America's image in the world, there seems to have emerged a couple of different consensuses, one of which is that the best form of diplomacy for the United States is what President Eisenhower called people-to-people contact. I'll quote to you Edward R. Murrow, who's best known probably as a television producer, but he was also the first director of the USIA, the United States Information Agency. He said once, "The really crucial link in the international communication chain is the last 3 feet, which is bridged by personal contact, one person talking with another." So the question on the table, which I pose today, is that globalization has greatly increased the quantity of person-to-person contacts between Americans and others around the world. This happens through various avenues. It happens through the military. It happens through missionary work, educational exchange, NGOs, business, and tourism, although the mission of tourism is not really to sort of bear the glad tidings of the United States in quite the way that these other activities are. Now, I have lots to say about all of those things, but I'm going to focus today on missionaries and, for contrast, on higher educational exchange. Seems to be out of place. Okay. Oh, yeah. I don't know what those. I have 2 items in my paper that don't really belong there. There'll be 3 parts to the talk. The first is I'm going to discuss some of the drawbacks of these people-to-people contacts, some of the problems that are developing as these people-to-people programs and contacts between Americans and others have greatly expanded. And then I'm going to address something which is, of course, dear to my heart. The fact that since most people around the world don't meet Americans and don't travel to the U.S., the main source of their information about the United States is our popular culture, which of course has been widely disseminated more than ever before throughout the world. And then I'll relate these topics, or at least I will try to relate them, back to the question of religion and the American ability to do what a lot of people think we ought to be doing now, which is to engage others in a religious dialogue and, more ambitiously, to export our traditions of religious freedom and tolerance, hence the title of my talk. First, I want to address the fact that although our contacts with others may be increasing in quantity, I'm not sure they're increasing in quality. 2 major problems. One is that there are larger numbers of Americans venturing forth overseas than at any previous time, but they tend to be staying for shorter periods. And they tend to be staying inside what is commonly referred to as the American bubble. This American bubble is a protean thing that can take many forms, but it is really a very stubborn reality, and it's very hard for Americans to get out of it. Second of all is a clash of social mores, the way Americans oftentimes within their bubble behave in societies in foreign countries where our social mores are in sharp contrast with those of the host country. Now these play out differently in these different avenues that I mentioned, and there's no time to talk about all of them, so I'll focus first on missionary work, and then I'll turn from missionary work to higher education. Missionaries have a reputation for a cultural savvy because so many of them have spent so long immersed in another culture and becoming very proficient in the language and getting to know the ways of the people they deal with extremely well. But in recent years, there's been a huge increase in short-term missionary work. There are roughly 120,000 evangelical Protestant, Mormon, Roman Catholic, and mainstream Protestants going out from the United States to do missionary work overseas now. There's roughly 25% of these go to Africa, the same percentage go to Latin America, and also to Europe, and about 17% go to Asia. Yet, of all these, only the Catholics and the Mormons track the numbers of missionaries. All the different Protestant organizations used to have overarching sort of authorities, agencies that would send the missionaries and keep track of them, but that's gone by the boards. There are just thousands of churches and semi-churches and church-like organizations sending people abroad for shorter and shorter periods of time and for a variety of motives. And so you have a troubling trend. What we think of as traditional missionary work, or at least what I used to think of it as a kind of lifelong vocation or long-term commitment at most, or at least, is sort of yielding, I would say, to a short-term diversion. The Mormons still require their missionaries to stay at least between 18 months and 2 years, depending on where they're going. But the vast majority makes no such demand. On the contrary, the number of American Christians going overseas for a few days or a few weeks has exploded since the 1980s. In 2001, the number of long-term Protestant missionaries was estimated at 42,787, if you want an exact figure. That was long-term. I hope I didn't say short-term. That was long-term. Whereas the number for short-term missionaries that same year was 346,225, give or take a couple. Robert Wuthnow reports that in 2005, between 1.5 and 1.8 million Americans took mission trips abroad. 83% of these were 2 weeks or less. Now, this isn't inherently a bad idea. I know that BC sends a lot of students on what might be called mission trips to various places. But in many cases, there are some problems, that the people who go abroad in this way lack training in missionary work. They lack any knowledge or understanding of the culture and the language and the history of the countries they're visiting. And sometimes they lack even the practical skills for the jobs that they undertake to do, like building houses. And some lack the right motives. Now, I'm going to give you a couple of bad examples just for amusement's sake. The director of the World Mission Associates, a man named Glenn Schwartz, quotes a church bulletin inviting worshipers to join, and I quote, "a women's only mission to beautiful Guadalajara, Mexico, also known as the shopping capital of Mexico." And the head of Global Learning Center at Grand Rapids Theological Seminary, a man named Dave Livermore, asked 250 foreign pastors what they hate most about American mission projects. Here was a typical answer. "You're obsessed with picture taking and making videos during our evangelical programs. It's really quite embarrassing for us." So this general phenomenon of what some have called gospel tourism, it has even deeper problems. Glenn Schwartz relates a story of a United States and Canadian group building a church in Zimbabwe. And in the words of a local man who was supposedly in charge of the project, and I quote, "What the Americans didn't know is that we here in Africa also know how to build buildings. They thought they were the only ones who knew. Finally, things got so bad, we had to ask them to leave." Another big problem is American material affluence and how Americans were well off, were much better off than a lot of the people who are visited on these trips, And we also think of ourselves as very generous. But this does not always lead to a good outcome. Here's another story from a missionary source. It was about a short-term American missionary serving in West Africa in a congregation which, after great pain and effort over a considerable amount of time, had finally raised the funds to plant a church in a nearby village. The amount of money that they had raised was $110, which to them was a very substantial amount of money. But this short-term missionary, who was, you know, overcome with sympathy and pity for these people, decided to donate to them her savings of $6,800. And to quote Glenn Schwartz again, "The result was that the pastor immediately began to ask where he could find more of that kind of money. And the long-term missionary who was in place there, who had served there for several years, who had been teaching principles of self-support and self-sustainment, saw all of his efforts go down the drain." This is actually, as I'm sure some of you know, a very big issue in missionary work, that the short-termers don't understand how long it takes to imbue your flock with certain values, and how it's very easy for others to fly in and hand out money and so forth. But know well, these examples are taken from the missionary literature. So I think, like soldiers or NGO workers who have been seasoned by long and hard experience, a lot of people in the missionary field have climbed up a very steep learning curve. And they are trying to make use of what in the military are called lessons learned, to kind of cycle this understanding back into the process. But as I say, it's a little bit it's quite out of control. There's so many people doing it, and so many people rushing forth to do good and to feel good in other parts of the world, that it's really hard to apply some of the hard-won knowledge. But on the other hand, there are some things that are even more troubling. For example, our own field of higher education. Educators proudly note that since 1985, the number of U.S. students going overseas has increased fivefold. But the Institute of International Education reports that nearly 60% of the American students going abroad spend less than 8 weeks. And the percentage spending an academic or a calendar year, the old junior year abroad, is now at about 4.4. Now here's another problem kicks in. There are, of course, many good programs, all of them from BC. No, there are many good programs. But in many cases, the real meaning of study abroad has come to mean young Americans confusing foreign countries with Fort Lauderdale. I asked my seniors a couple of years ago to write a new chapter for the book, The Ugly Americans, and they wrote these absolutely bone-chilling descriptions of binge drinking and partying in European capitals, and of going abroad not for any reason except to kick back and have a good time. So I don't know if they were reporting what they had really experienced or what they'd heard from other students, but it made for quite depressing reading. It could be that the harm of this is well contained because, as former diplomat William Keel has written, most of these programs are limited to just a few weeks and take place in an English language environment, in sort of a transplanted American college environment in a European capital. So this kind of behavior on the part of American students isn't going into countries where social mores are drastically different from those of the United States yet. I've heard things about even Peace Corps volunteers misbehaving in this way. And I think that the American, campus life, for all of its problems, does not export very well. And the farther it goes afield, the more problems it's likely to create. And there doesn't seem to be much of a learning curve in this area. I've talked to a lot of people in the field of international education. When I raised this, they sort of changed the subject. But that's not a systematic survey. I'm sure there are people concerned with it. So now I want to talk about the impact of popular culture. This is the kind of the core of my book. It's certainly the starting point of my book. How am I doing for time?
It's really interesting, but we also want to leave time for time.
Okay. Since the 1990s and the end of the Cold War, I can just tell you what you already know, which is that the export of American popular culture by legal methods and, of course, through piracy has increased exponentially. The Bureau of Economic Analysis estimates between 1986 and 2005 a five-fold increase of the export of filmed and recorded American entertainment. The foreign box office, as we all learned when Avatar came out, is more than twice the domestic box office and increasing all the time. And the report for the Motion Picture Association that was done in 2006 reported a loss of $6 billion due to piracy, and 80% of it outside the United States. Now, the Motion Picture Association has an interest in having that be a large number, but the report, I think, was a respectable report. It's impossible to estimate. But through piracy and legal distribution, American entertainment products are everywhere in the world, subtitled on television, most of all, file shared, cheap knockoff DVDs for sale everywhere. I traveled around the world doing research for my book into 9 cities in 6 different countries, and everywhere I went, young people that I met were intimately familiar with American TV shows and all sorts of things. I could elaborate on that. So maybe I'll just quickly sum up this next part, which if you know anything about my work, you know that I'm somewhat critical of the direction that American popular culture has taken in the last couple of decades. Just suffice it to say that over 60% of Americans are concerned about what's on television and what their children are seeing and hearing. And I sort of, there are a number of different reasons for this, which I've written about extensively elsewhere. But I just would say that we face a kind of unprecedented situation right now. In the first instance, our popular culture has fewer controls at the point of origin than ever before. The Motion Picture Code, of course, disappeared in 68. The rating system for motion pictures doesn't really apply to most of the distribution system for motion pictures. The television channels are minimally regulated by the producers. And of course, cable TV has always escaped any legal restraint and has escaped also the regime of self-regulation. So cable TV shows just about everything and produces a lot of stuff, which sometimes has great artistic merit, but is oftentimes very in your face and pushing the envelope in all sorts of ways. Now, what I would say is that Americans, when we look at this, we sort of, you know, a lot of us don't like it. A lot of us worry about our kids. But most of us do not mistake it for reality. We see the distortion of a lot of popular culture. We understand that not all Americans. Well, I'll give you the description. I have a good source for the description right here. The State Department did a study of a foreign visitors program. They do a lot of these follow-up studies. And this was done of 60 Mexicans who came to the United States in 1999 and 2000. And they were interviewed in depth by a fellow named Gerald Kielsen, who was working for the State Department at the time. This is part of his report that he shared with me. "People who watch U.S. television shows, attend Hollywood movies, and listen to pop music can't help but believe that we are a nation in which we have sex with strangers regularly, where we wander the streets well-armed and prepared to shoot our neighbors at any provocation, and where the lifestyle to which we aspire is one of rich, cocaine-snorting, decadent sybarites. This is not an accurate description of the U.S., nor is it attractive to many people around the world. The Mexican visitors were very clear that their images of America, shaped by commercial media, were inaccurate and distorted and gave them a negative perception of the United States." So as I say, Americans correct the picture, visitors who come here correct the picture, but the vast majority of people in the world, many of whom have little or no knowledge of the United States other than what they see in popular culture, are not in a position to correct the picture. So how does this relate to religion? There is now a growing call to engage the world through religious dialogue and to share with others our tradition of religious freedom and tolerance. Not just at the elite level, but also at the grassroots. There's a lot of talk of, you know, engaging people on the ground. I'll just quote you from a recent report from the Chicago Council that just came out. This is an executive summary of the goals we should be aiming at. It says, To connect with billions of people of faith, the U.S. must engage with them on issues that touch their daily lives. In much of the world, particularly Latin America, Africa, Southeast Asia, many schools, hospitals, social services, relief and development, and human rights programs are sponsored by religious institutions. While these activities may appear to be non-political, in the aggregate, they have a powerful influence over people's lives and loyalties. By engaging with them, the United States can help build goodwill in religious communities and connect directly with ordinary citizens. That sounds fine. But I have read the entire report from the Chicago Council. Stunningly to me, it says nothing about popular culture. It says not a word about this massive tutorial that the world is getting in the ways of American life. They talk about many, many other things, but not once do they talk about the fact that most people in the world, most ordinary people in the world, get their impressions of the U.S. from popular culture. I should say, just in passing, when you look at opinion poll data, the World Attitude Survey, the Pew Global Attitude Survey, all these polls, in the last several years, there has developed a kind of conventional wisdom that most people around the world like American popular culture, even if they hate American foreign policy. I think there was a Writers Guild session in Los Angeles shortly after 9/11, which had the title that sums it all up: "We hate you, but keep sending us Baywatch." And that's the conventional wisdom. But if you look a little bit more closely at the polls, you find a different pattern. For example, in the most recent 47-nation survey that Pew did in 2009, there were drops in the positive opinion toward American popular culture in several different countries, and I have some figures here. But more suggestively, there was a steep drop in many places of the world, including Western Europe, a rise in the number of people agreeing with the following statement: "It is bad that American customs and ideas are spreading here." Big rises in this. And Pew don't try to connect that with the subject of popular culture, but it raises a big question mark in my mind. Where do all these people learn about American ideas and customs? I think at least one should investigate the possibility that they're learning about it through our entertainment, our exported entertainment media. So what does our entertainment and popular culture say about this great topic of American religious freedom and tolerance, not to mention the place of religion in American life? I would say either nothing or something negative. As we all know, religious figures in popular culture are almost always portrayed as buffoons, as malicious, puritanical types who are trying to get in the way of somebody's freedom, usually somebody's sexual freedom, usually somebody's individual sexual freedom to break loose of family, community, and so forth. And they, insofar as our popular culture highlights a kind of extreme version of individual freedom, disassociated from the kind of communitarian things that other people around the world take for granted, it's both appealing to young people, but it's also, I think, it repels at the same time that it attracts. That's a complicated reaction that I've talked to a lot of people about in my travels. Even within the same individual, you can get a strong attraction to Sex and the City, to Friends, to programs of young people living on their own, having nice apartments, lots of money, don't have to work very hard, and you get to sleep with all your friends and associates, and there's no bad consequences. And your parents, your family, your aunts and uncles, your cousins, religious leaders, everyone from your community are completely out of the picture. This is appealing to young people who are enmeshed in family, extended family, three generations, as in the case of most Indian families, with lots of watchful relatives and lots of watchful adults who live at home until they marry, and sometimes after they marry, continue to live with their parents. This is a kind of image of sort of individual freedom and autonomy that's quite appealing. But you talk to people at a greater length and they'll say, well, that's okay for Americans, but I wouldn't really want to live that way. And in the long run, it creates a kind of sense that Americans, there's something inhuman about Americans. there's a famous quotation that floated around Washington a couple of years ago. A study was done by, it was called the Djigirian Report. Former Ambassador Edward Djigirian did a big study about American public diplomacy. And in that study, he was asked by a Syrian teacher, a woman who was teaching English in Syria. She said, tell me, does the TV program Friends represent a typical American family? And in my travels, I had many young people say to me, Americans are always alone. They're always alone. They always live in apartments by themselves. And you start looking, I tell you, you start looking at American movies and TV shows through this lens, and it is absolutely stunning. And we know the reasons for it, or at least we could speculate what the reasons are. And we know that this is either a phase of life or it's just the way our entertainment likes to focus things because they're trying to appeal to a certain demographic and 99 other reasons. Anyway, it's a major distortion. And it relates to religion because it, among the things that are absent from the screen is any sort of religious life, any sort of involvement in a religious community, never mind the sort of ugly caricature of puritanical religion, which is a stock in trade in American entertainment, I think, for a long time. But now it's projected all around the world. So, to conclude, so I foresee a kind of, because this reality of popular culture is kind of missing from, I find it missing from a lot of the literature on religious engagement, I foresee a certain bad chemistry developing, where on the one hand, Americans are preaching about religious freedom and tolerance, and on the other hand, we're pumping into the world images of our lifestyle and our society that give a bad name to religious freedom and tolerance, because we don't do a very good job of conveying what it actually means and what religion actually means in the formation of character and public morality in the United States. Instead, we encourage other people really to conclude, as many Muslims have and as many other religious people have. By the way, this is not a reaction confined to Muslims. That U.S. religion is shallow, self-serving, hypocritical, and morally lax to the point of placing individual freedom above God. So the other thing about this literature of engagement that strikes me is it's extremely utopian. The list of goals that are going to be achieved surpass anything that Mother Teresa or John Paul II ever tried to do. And I'm just very skeptical. But I do think some things could be done if we set certain modest goals. One of the things that I've been thinking about for some time is the idea of putting young people together who are trying to create an alternative to the dominant youth culture, religious young people. You might start with American Muslims and have them interact with Muslims from another country about how do you have Muslim hip-hop? You know, how do you live in this youth culture and stay true to your faith? This is a very, very important topic to most young Muslims around the world, much more important than U.S. foreign policy. They're really concerned with how can I live in my faith and be modern and partake of all these good Western things. And there are American youth struggling with the same questions. So I think that might be a possible avenue. But more generally, I think we need to be more mindful of what this message is that we're sending out around the world and address it in as many ways and venues as we possibly can. At the moment, we seem to have a blind spot about it, but that's why I'm writing my book. Thank you very much.